Coming up in the next hour on Morning Ireland, we'll be talking to Professor John McHale of the Fiscal Advisory Council on the pre-budget advice they're giving the government, summed up in one word, prudence. The UN High Commission for Refugees, woman in Turkey, talks to us about how they're going to look after the Kurds who've crossed, fled into Turkey from Syria at a rate of about 20,000 a day over the last 2 days. We've advice at the other end of the news spectrum, advice for anyone who suddenly has a lot of money to spend, like an €86 million lottery win. And Marty Morrissey joins Porrick from the Kerry Teams Hotel. That's in the next 60 minutes.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 22nd of September. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Cathal McCullough and Gavin Jennings.
The headlines. In its pre-budget submission, the Fiscal Advisory Council urges the government to be prudent and to stick to its plan of tax rises and spending cuts. A study by the Society of Chartered Surveyors says that 35,000 new homes will be needed in Dublin between now and 2018. And Turkey has closed some of its border crossings with Syria after 100,000 Kurdish refugees fled an offensive by Islamic State militants. The news in full from Brian Jennings.
The Fiscal Advisory Council has urged the government to stick to its original plan to save €2 billion through tax increases and spending cuts in Budget 2015, despite an improving economic situation and stronger tax revenues. In a pre-budget statement published today, the independent statutory body of economists has warned against easing up on austerity. Our economics correspondent, Sean Whelan.
Things are going well now, and the government is getting a lot more tax revenue than it expected at the start of the year. So much so that the finance minister has said the next budget could be neutral, with no more tax increases or spending cuts needed. But the Fiscal Advisory Council thinks easing back now would be dangerous. The very high government debt level, now 1.2 times the size of the economy, leaves the state finances vulnerable to shocks like recession or interest rate rises. It argues that a large part of this year's planned €2 billion adjustment should come from a mix of tax rises and spending cuts, rather than relying on extra revenue from a rising economy. It says this would leave the state far better positioned to deal with its big debt in a gradual way over time. It also warns against eroding or constraining the state's ability to raise further revenues and says a growing and ageing population will make it very hard for the state to keep control of its medium-term spending plans.
A new report on housing needs in Dublin has suggested that 35,000 new homes will be required in the capital between now and 2018 to meet demand. However, the study by the Society of Chartered Surveyors Ireland has said planning approval has been granted for just 26,000 homes, resulting in a shortfall of 9,000 units. Justin McCarthy reports.
This report examines the housing needs of Dublin between now and 2018. It found that there are 2,223 hectares of land zoned and potentially available for residential development in the Dublin region. The zoned land could deliver over 100,000 additional housing units if needed. According to the report, there's a minimum housing requirement of just over 35,000 housing units over the next 4 years. However, there's only granted planning permission for some 26,000 units, resulting in a shortfall of 9,000 units. The biggest housing requirement is in the Dublin City Council area, where there's demand for almost 14,000 units, but only planning permission granted for 1,200 homes. In Fingal, by contrast, there's demand for almost 10,000 units, while planning permission has been granted for almost 17,000 homes. The Society of Chartered Surveyors says a more streamlined planning process is needed to develop houses in the areas of greatest demand.
Turkey has begun to close some of its border crossings with Syria following an influx of nearly 100,000 Kurdish refugees over the weekend to escape an offensive by the self-styled militant group Islamic State. Most of the refugees were from the northern town of Kobane, which has been targeted by IS. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has said that only 2 of the 9 border posts in the area remained open. The former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has said that Western ground forces should not be ruled out in the fight against IS in Iraq and Syria. The United States and France have insisted, instead, launched airstrikes against the militants as part of an international coalition. Mr. Blair said he believed an air campaign may only contain the militant group for a time, and that ground forces would ultimately be needed.
We're already giving significant help on the ground. We're already conducting airstrikes. This is the broad alliance of nations. You know, if necessary, we shouldn't rule out, as this evolves, and if it's necessary, rule out the use of some particularly special force capabilities. My point, though, is very simple. All of our experience teaches us that unless you're prepared to fight these people on the ground, you may contain them, but you won't defeat them.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron is to host a summit of senior Conservative MPs at Chequers today to discuss plans to limit voting rights of Scottish MPs at Westminster. Mr. Cameron said that a pledge to give Scotland more powers following last week's referendum, in which 55% of people voted to remain in the United Kingdom, should go hand in hand with changing the role of Scottish politicians. However, the Labour leader Ed Miliband has opposed linking the issue with constitutional change for England. That would allow English MPs to have greater scrutiny of legislation. Ireland is to provide €600,000 as well as emergency supplies to help communities in Sierra Leone and Liberia affected by the Ebola virus. The Minister of State at the Department of Foreign Affairs, Sean Sherlock, said the aid would include over 40 tonnes of emergency supplies, such as blankets, tents, mosquito nets and water tanks. The announcement of aid follows the ending of a three-day curfew in Sierra Leone aimed at containing the outbreak of Ebola, which has so far killed more than 2,600 people in West Africa. Officials said 22 new cases of the virus were identified during the lockdown. An American software engineering company has announced the creation of 100 new jobs in Northern Ireland. Puppet Labs, which is used by companies such as Twitter, eBay and PayPal, plans to launch a new operation in Belfast over the next 3 years. The Enterprise, Trade and Investment Minister Arlene Foster has described the investment as a significant boost to the local economy. Now the time is coming up to 7 minutes past 8.
Deirdre Purcell is back with It Says in the Papers.
Images of jubilant Kerry supporters and players dominate the front pages of the Irish Times, Irish Independent and Irish Examiner this morning. But the headline stories in all three papers make for sober reading. As you heard in the bulletin, the Fiscal Council has warned that the government should publish a prudent budget this year. That makes the lead for the Times. For the Independent, the lead is that politicians and civil servants found guilty of corruption will be forced out of office and banned from returning to their posts for up to 10 years, according to new legislation. The Examiner runs that Fiscal Council report on its front page too. But for its main story this morning, Catherine Shanahan writes that public hospital services for treating children with potentially lethal allergies are completely swamped, with year-long waits for first appointments and 3 years for a food allergy test. So what else? Food and drink exports topped €10 billion last year. That's in almost all the papers this morning. The health supplement with today's Independent has tested probiotic drinks and supplements with somewhat surprising results. And it also runs a two-page investigation about vaping. That's using e-cigarettes instead of the traditional variety. The government here, we're told, is working on legislation to regulate their use. And we're also told that sales of the devices jumped by 478% in 2013. Dublin's rickshaw business is being targeted by a criminal gang which is trying to take over the lucrative business. That's in the Mirror. There's been a rare sighting of killer whales, a pod of seven, near the deep-water Porcupine Sea Bight off the southwest coast. Researchers aboard the Marine Institute's Celtic Explorer watched them breach for 20 minutes. That's in the Examiner, with a picture of one of the cetaceans in the Mail, three in the Mirror. And the Mail informs us that the Irish bankruptcy official in charge of Sean Dunn's case in the US is trying to freeze the €18 million proceeds of the sale of a South African hotel. The hotel had been transferred by the developer to his wife Gail Killalay in exchange for her love, her affection and in honour of their children. The National Museum has closed some galleries and has had to cut back on educational tours due to funding cuts and staff recruitment restrictions, with another institution, the National Library, warning that its funding has reached a critical point. That's from Lorna Siggins in The Times. Adele King, alias Twink, has put up a reward for the safe return of her Yorkshire Terrier, Teddy, that she believes has been stolen. Teddy was last seen outside her house in Rathfarnham, and that's in The Sun. And finally, from the Irish Times, Lara Marlowe writes from Paris that ex-president Nicolas Sarkozy plans to return to French politics, saying that he cannot ignore the suffering of his compatriots.
Thank you very much, Deirdre Purcell. Prudence is a word we can all agree on, but what exactly should prudence mean when Michael Noonan presents his budget along with Brendan Howlin in the Dáil next month? The Fiscal Advisory Council has a view. Before we come to their view and to get their out explanation of it, let's listen to what Michael Noonan had to say most recently. This is after the publication of very encouraging growth figures from the Central Statistics Office last year, with revenue up and growth up. This is how the Minister of Finance saw his task in the budget and how he would do it.
We'll still have to do a 2 billion consolidation, because to get from where we were, a deficit of 4.8 to 2.9, it requires a consolidation of 2.1 billion. But the thing is that we won't have to do it by extra taxes or extra cutbacks. There is enough tax buoyancy in the growing economy to deliver the resources to do that level of consolidation, as I say, without increasing taxes or without cutting expenditure further.
That's Michael Noonan speaking last Thursday. Joining us now from RTE's Galway studio, Professor John McHale, Chairman of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, which has presented its latest advice to the government this morning. John McHale, good morning.
Good morning, Colin.
And just to confirm with you that Michael Noonan was speaking last Thursday before he'd got your latest advice, correct?
That's right.
Now, he's saying we can do it painlessly. You're saying the opposite. Why?
Well, in this statement, we're really making two main points. The more general concern is that there is a danger that we'll repeat the pattern of relaxing fiscal discipline in better economic times. And we know that in the past that's contributed to the boom-bust cycle that's done so much damage to the economy and people's lives. The more specific advice is that there really should be a last push in the fiscal adjustment, essentially following through on the government's previously stated plans. In terms of why, the minister is right that the new growth figures and the exchequer returns do indicate that the target of getting the deficit below 3% of GDP next year can be met with an adjustment of less than 2 billion. But getting the deficit below 3% of GDP is certainly not the sole target. We still have a deficit of 7 billion this year. We have a huge debt. So we're still in quite a vulnerable position in a fragile international economy. And we still have a distance to go in the fiscal adjustment. We need to get to a balanced budget. So we don't think now is the time to be scaling back. And we think that final big push should be pursued.
Which is a message we heard from you, I think, earlier this year. Now, bearing in mind that very positive editorial in the Financial Times this morning, which nevertheless says that there are things to worry about, particularly the level of debt you just spoken about, which they say is going to be at dangerous levels for years to come. 7 billion, you say, will be the deficit between the difference between what the government takes in and what it spends next year, even with this buoyancy. So, given the fact that we've heard Michael Noonan say he's going to do what he's going to do, he's not going to take your advice, essentially, what's your view of the risks we'll run?
There certainly are substantial risks. As I mentioned, the international environment is still quite fragile. So At the moment, our borrowing costs are low, and I don't think immediately doing a smaller adjustment than the 2 billion will put at risk the creditworthiness of the state or anything. But if we were to be hit by some negative news, having a higher debt, and also having given up some of the credibility that we've earned by really following through on plans, would put us in a more fragile position. By doing less adjustment, it certainly sort of helps the economy in the short run, but increases the risks over the longer term.
Do you have any problem with the tax cuts, for example, those promised by the Taoiseach last Friday, the 1% tax cut cut on the top rate?
Well, I think we have to recognise, as your piece with Sean Whelan noted earlier, we face very strong spending pressures over the next number of years, partly related to demographics. We're also going to be carrying a large legacy of the crisis in terms of higher interest costs. So, unfortunately, the adjustments really are not something that are temporary and now can be unwound. So this doesn't seem to be the right point in time to be reducing the revenue raising capacity of the state.
After, I think it's 6 years of austerity budgets of one kind or another, does it not make sense, if things are picking up in a responsible way, and Michael Noonan has said he's promised he'll be responsible and sensible, but does it not make sense to a degree to try and encourage an investment, to try and encourage personal consumption spending through breaks of some kind or another to taxpayers?
Well, the adjustment has, of course, placed a huge burden on people, and we absolutely understand the desire to have some easing up at this point. But we have to recognise that any additional borrowing now is going to have to be paid back with interest. So it certainly is not going to be free money by any means. Also, the economy is now growing at 4.5%, well above estimates, the government's own estimates of the sustainable rate. So the case for a more sort of counter-cyclical policy to try to boost the economy, if anything, is probably weaker at this point.
Just a final question about advice which you give, which is not followed, and it looks like this is going to happen on this occasion again. Do you ever think of considering your position and saying, what's the point of this?
Well, we do think that the government takes our advice on board. One of the things that we emphasised a lot in the previous report was the dangers of the boom-bust cycle. And I think that's very much been taken on board by the government. And you can see that in statements from both Minister Noonan and Minister Hallin. I think you're right. The real test of the Fiscal Advisory Council will come in good times. And that's really why we were set up, so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. But one thing we're not going to do is align our advice with what the government is going to do anyway. So we'll take the criticism that they're not following our advice, but I think it's probably the criticism is properly directed at the people not taking the advice rather than the advice givers.
Professor John McHale, thank you very much for coming into our Galway studio.
Going to Turkey now, where over 70,000 people have crossed over the border from Syria over the weekend. They say they're fleeing an advance by Islamic State fighters. Carol Batchelor is United Nations Human Rights Commission representative in Turkey. She's on the phone now from Ankara. Carol, good morning to you. What are people saying?
Good morning.
What are people saying about what's happening in Syria? Why are they leaving in such big numbers this weekend?
Thank you. And just one point of clarification. I'm the representative for the UN Refugee Agency.
My apologies.
People are saying that they are fleeing in such numbers because of the conflict on the other side of the border. They are very fearful about encroachments into where the safe areas where they live, or in some instances already whole towns have been overrun. So people are fleeing not for lack of water or food. People are fleeing for their lives and to save the lives of their family members.
There are reports that Turkey is closing the border, not only to stop more people coming in, but also to stop people going back into Syria to fight IS.
Well, I think this illustrates how the situation is evolving in a very complex and challenging way. Indeed, all states are responsible for security, including at their borders. At the same time, states are responsible for ensuring that people who are civilians, who are in need, have access to territory so that they can save their lives. And it can be very complex and challenging to manage both of these issues. We understand that the number of border crossings has reduced, and the authorities are trying to channel people through two specific areas where they have facilities on the Turkish side of the border to receive people, to provide medical assistance where that's necessary, to register people, go through security checks, and then from there people are, many are being sent to host families in Turkey. Turkey is also building two new camps in addition to the 22 refugee camps already here. And UNHCR is providing support to them for the building of the camps. We've managed to bring 20 trucks of relief aid, but we do need much more assistance. We're undertaking airlifts and other types to ensure humanitarian assistance reaches this magnitude of people. I want to underline that in the past 3 days, more people have crossed in this short time period than has ever happened in the last 3.5 years. And there are already 1.35 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. So the needs are absolutely staggering as we head into the winter months.
How is Turkey managing, Carol? Because as you've said, like many immediate neighbours to Syria, it has taken in a huge number of refugees, whereas other countries who have promised to take in refugees from Syria have only taken in very small numbers by comparison.
Well, Turkey has done a remarkable job of letting people come, of setting up facilities, and of, you will see in these camps, a level of assistance that can be very hard to achieve elsewhere. The problem is the sheer number of the camps that exist in Turkey today. There are about 230,000 Syrians living in the camps. That means over 1.1 million people are not in camps, are fending for themselves in the urban setting. There is access to medical care. We are working with the authorities on education of the 600,000 children who are here, and so on. But the magnitude is absolutely staggering. This would be a challenge for any country. And this is why it's so important to send the signal to the neighboring countries, to the host communities who are sharing resources with Syrian refugees, and most importantly, to the Syrian refugees themselves, that in this critical moment, there was international solidarity to meet their core life-saving needs. This will empower people to look to the future and to anticipate a day when they can return to their country and hopefully rebuild, reconstruct, and bring peace and stability to the region.
Just very briefly before I let you go, Carol, whatever about international aid for the neighboring countries of Syria, would that aid be better served by accepting more Syrian refugees into countries within the EU, or more assistance coming from those countries in the EU to neighbouring countries like Turkey, like Jordan, like the Lebanon?
This is an important question, and I think we've come to a point where both are needed. Our High Commissioner has appealed to all states globally to allow Syrians access to their territory, to reunite with family members who live abroad, to relax the visa regime so that, of course, we're speaking of civilians. 80% of the refugee population is composed of women and children. Over 50% are children. This is the fourth year where their education is interrupted. So in our collective global interest, again, if we hope to see peace and stability one day in Syria, we really need to make the investment now, wherever the Syrians might be.
Carol Batchelor, UNHCR rep in Turkey, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has appealed to member states to assist the drive against the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. The announcement just made, you've heard about it during the bulletin this morning, by the Minister for Development, Trade, Promotion at the Department of Foreign Affairs, Sean Sherlock, that €600,000 is going to be spent. He's on the line now to tell us how. Sean Sherlock, good morning.
Good morning, Cathal.
So €600,000 to assist. Obviously, a lot of more money is going to be involved, but this is our contribution. How's it going to be spent?
Well, we have taken a decision to invest €600,000 to the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. That's UNICEF as we know it. Because we feel that the best way to respond to this at this point in time is to divest monies to ensure that we can provide nutritional supplies for children. Because what we're seeing is that there are approximately 5,000 victims so far. What we're seeing is that one in five our children, and what we're seeing is that with the high mortality rates and where mothers in particular are affected, we feel strongly that we need to divest funding through UNICEF to provide nutritional supplies and basic infant formula and food supplies. But on top of that, then we're providing 42 tons of very core commodities like blankets and mosquito nets and water tanks and soaps, and we want to make sure that they're divested directly to people from a humanitarian point of view. So in essence, we are focusing at this point in time on getting the aid to the families who are in isolation and in quarantine, and we want to make sure that children in particular who are affected by this will get the basic food supplies that they need.
Barry Andrews of Goal, who was on the programme last week, having just been to Sierra Leone, made two suggestions about what Ireland could do, apart from obviously giving money, which you've just announced, towards the effort to tackle a disease which is still very much presenting huge problems to the health services there. Now, one of the suggestions he was that looking at the possibility of deploying people with different forms of expertise, for example, in the HSE, for example, in the Army. And I know that one member of our Rapid Response Corps has been sent to Senegal to do what?
Well, effectively, Irish Aid has a system whereby there are people who are deployed in various regions throughout the globe who are experts, if you will. Maybe that could be medical, logistical. And what we do is we deploy that rapid response person or persons to various areas. So in this case, what we have done is we have deployed a rapid response person who will work with the World Food Programme so that when those stocks, and we call them stocks, those blankets, mosquito nets and tanks and so on, when they're deployed, we make sure through the rapid response person that they are divested or distributed in the best way possible.
Would you consider
people on the ground.
Would you consider offering any more expertise?
Well, absolutely, and that's an ongoing process. So where we are effectively at the moment is we're targeting children in terms of the disbursement of the €600,000 through UNICEF, but we're continually monitoring this. It's important also to state that we have an excellent ambassador as well. Ambassador Sinead Walsh is there on the ground, and so she's liaising with our department. And so what we will do is we will monitor ongoing processes. So, for instance, the next response may be coordinated in a more medical way as opposed to a humanitarian way, if you will. But we continue to monitor and continue to work with our ambassador on the ground.
There. Right, before you go, Minister, that other humanitarian crisis with an estimated 100,000 Kurds having crossed into Turkey from Syria. Now, the government has announced that it's going to let in a very small number of Syrians over the next few years. I think it's about roughly 150 a year. And we heard Carol Batchelor of the UN Refugee Agency there appealing to countries to relax restrictions, to take in more people because of the sheer scale of the crisis they're facing. Should that figure, that very low figure we've agreed to let in, as I say, it's about 150 a year, should that be reconsidered?
Well, I think, again, we monitor these numbers as time goes on.
But well, you know what's happening on the Turkish border. There are 100,000 people now who've left their homes and gone to another country. So the need is increasing.
The need is increasing, but I think the very fact that we agree to the principle of allowing people in and providing, refugee status, if you will, for those people in the first instance, that the basic principle is there and that Ireland will respond accordingly. And I think Ireland, historically, as it is doing now with this Ebola virus, is is ensuring that it will play its part in ensuring that from a humanitarian point of view, that people who are affected by, where you have these crises globally, that we have an appropriate response.
Sure. Should that figure of 150 a year, people from Syria who've had to leave their homes, refugees, should that figure be reconsidered at least?
Well, what we will do, Cathal, is we will, monitor that situation. If it is appropriate to take in more people, then we will, consider that. But I think it's important that we establish the principle that we will take people in the first instance. And historically, if you take the Bosnian crisis in the early 90s, we had an appropriate response to that as well.
Anyway, Sean Sherlock, Minister, thank you for talking to us.
Pádraic Lodge is here with the sports news on a Monday morning in September when Kerry are the All-Ireland champions again.
Yeah, the 37th time that they have been champions of Ireland, Gavin, and plenty of photographs of the celebrations in the newspapers this morning and the Sam Maguire Cup being lifted aloft. A most remarkable triumph, really, given Kerry's form in the league, and that the sense from the county was that the team was in transition. There was no great expectation of success, but I suppose it's just like it always was, and for so many occasions they are the champions.
Is it me, or there seemed to be more Kerry people at the All-Ireland yesterday than in previous years, and the team certainly stayed on the pitch for an awful lot longer afterwards.
Yeah, for the best part of an hour they were savouring the moment. The win clearly meant an awful lot to them and to their supporters. The final scoreline, 2-9 to Kerry, Donegal 12 points, a first title for Kerry since 2009, and it completed a double for the Kingdom. The minor team also overcame Donegal by 17 points to 110. Shortly we'll be live at the Kerry Team Hotel, but first of all Mike McCartney got the views of supporters leaving Croke Park.
Oh God, absolutely got it. Murphy's kick there at the end of the game, I thought it was going to go into the back of the net, but it was a close game, it was a good game, and the atmosphere around the place is just absolutely brilliant. Just the wrong team, as a Donegal man, the wrong team won on the day.
Donegal went into the second half, especially in the centre field.
So the best team won?
Yeah.
You're a happy Kerry man?
I am. I'm all the way from Tralee. Kieran Donnelly play great. They all play great now.
If I told you during the league that Kerry were going to win the All-Ireland this year...
Well, when I came out of the Clare game, I said no way, not a hope. No, they proved us wrong.
I'm a very happy Kerry woman. I would have thought we'd have had it by a couple of points, but try telling Brawley and the like that was going to happen.
Two men from Fermanagh, what did you think?
Not a good final, but the better team won.
Poor football. In my opinion, the football was poor, but at the end of the day, Kerry came out on top, and it was touch and go at all times.
Very disappointed, yes.
Disappointing from a Donegal perspective, like they didn't win the kickouts and all that there. Like that's why I see they lost the game. If we won a few more kickouts there in the middle of the field, like we could came away with a one there. But fair play to Kerry.
The best team won, yeah, unfortunately.
Well, the celebrations continued late into the night at the Clyde Court Hotel. We can cross there live now to join our Gaelic Games correspondent Marty Morrissey for further reaction. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning, Pádraic, and welcome to the Kerry winning hotel. We've moved from the Clyde Court to the Balls Bridge Hotel, where the team stayed here last night. I'm joined by 8 times All-Ireland medalist and Kerry selector Mikey Sheehy, and the brand new RTGA player of the match in the All-Ireland final, and indeed All-Ireland medalist Paul Murphy. Good morning, lads.
Morning, Marty.
Mikey, have you had time to draw breath and, as they say, a mature reflection, look back on yesterday's game?
Marty, it's difficult to look back on it. I suppose it was a fantastic occasion for Kerry. We haven't sat down and looked at the game yet. You know, there was a good bit of celebrations last night. But in the lead up to the game, we were quietly confident of this team. And thankfully, we came out on the right side of it.
But when you think, Mikey, of when yourself and Dermot and the rest of David Murphy joined Eamon Fitzmaurice in this, there was old Kerry are in transition, Paul Galvin retired, Tomás O'Shea, indeed, the man who has the number 5 jersey now, all retired, Gooch got injured. To do what you've done, kind of almost from nowhere, if I could say that in this instance, it appeared from nowhere, is remarkable.
Yeah, I suppose when you win, it's great, but it all comes down to the players, to be fair. Eamon put a strategy in place, he's a very astute guy, but in fairness, the players bought into it from day one, and in fairness to those guys, they're so tight as a group, they're so dedicated, and in fairness to those guys, we got results yesterday, thanks be to God.
Well, joining me is the RTGA player of the match in the All-Ireland Final, Paul Murphy. Good morning, Paul.
Morning, Marty.
Well, it's the morning after the night before. Has it dawned on you that you're now an All-Ireland medalist and indeed recognised as one of the best halfbacks in the country after your first championship season?
I suppose the simple answer is no, it hasn't dawned on me yet. It hasn't sunk in at all. I'd say it'd probably be later in the week. It's almost, I'd say, a shock still. It's been an unbelievable year, I suppose, for the first year in the panel. I'm not naive enough to think you're going to win All-Irelands and get man of the match every year, but fantastic experience. And, you know, just the euphoria after the game yesterday, that 5 minutes after the game with the players and the management, that's the feeling you want to replicate. So try and get it again in the years to come.
Well, you're a role model for so many people because you never actually got on the Kerry minor team. I know you played under 21, but you didn't make the minor team. But you never gave up.
No, I suppose I was a small enough young lad. I suppose I'm still not a huge man, but I was small enough as a young lad, and it's probably a bit of physically weak for the minors. But you know, of course, I kept playing with the club. Club is, you know, is where you start and where you finish. So I kept playing with the club, and it was Eamon Fitz at under 21 level. He took a punt on me in 2012, and then again at the start of this year. So I like a huge debt of gratitude to Eamon for giving me my chance. And yeah, you know, I suppose you keep playing with the club and hope the opportunities will come along.
What was the feeling like when that full-time whistle went, when you knew you had your first All-Ireland medal?
I don't know. I think I actually sunk to my knees. I am, you know, I'm not too sure. It was incredible, yeah. Beyond my wildest dreams, really. Unbelievable stuff.
And Mikey, to be a selector, having done it all before yourself, and to be part, see, build a team with Eamon Fitzmaurice and see them go up and get the Sam Maguire, must have been a great moment for you as well.
Yeah, Marty, a special moment, you know, but as Paul says, there's nothing can replace playing on the field, you know, and tis the next best thing. But in fairness to Eamon, you know, look, Eamon is a very astute manager, to be fair to the guy, and everything, you know, it worked out. A lot of people had doubts about us, even coming into the game yesterday, but thankfully everything worked out on the day, you know, and you can't beat hard work. These guys like Paul, you know, they work hard. They do their gym sessions, everything. They're so dedicated, like every other county. But to be fair to these guys, they got the reward yesterday.
I'd leave the last question to you, Paul, because the first stop on the train home is Ratmore Railway Station. And, of course, you're from Ratmore. You're looking forward to that.
Yeah, I am. I am, Marty. Can't wait for that now. I remember, it's not too long ago, I was there in the crowd cheering on Tom Sullivan and Aidan Mahoney and Declan. So just to be up there now myself, I'm really looking forward to now, yeah.
Well done, Paul Murphy and Mikey Shee. Thank you both indeed for joining us. From championship debutant this year to an All-Ireland medalist, well done to both of you. Pádraig.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. That's our Gaelic Games correspondent, Marty Morrissey. Away from Gaelic Games in the English Premier League, there was a 1-1 draw between Manchester City and Chelsea. Frank Lampard came on as a late substitute and scored the equalising goal for Manchester City, although we didn't celebrate afterwards. Not a great afternoon for Manchester United. They were 3-1 up with half an hour to play against Leicester City, but ended up losing 5-3. It was the first game in the Premier League era that United, first time in the Premier League era that United had lost a game, having held a 2-goal lead.
Yeah, so somebody tweeted last night a question, quiz question maybe in years to come: why is King Richard III and Manchester United, why are they alike? Because both were buried in Leicester.
Okay. Elsewhere in the SSC Electricity League Premier Division, Cork City beat Limerick 1-0 at Thomond Park. Rob Lee Han with the goal. The win cuts Dundalk's lead at the top of the table to 3 points. Shane Lowry finished in a tie for second place at the Wales Open Golf in Celtic Manor. He shot a final round of 70 to end on 13 under par alongside England's Tommy Fleetwood. They were one shot behind the winner, Dutchman Joost Luton. And Ireland's under 21 eventing team won team gold at the European Championships in Portugal. The team will arrive into Dublin Airport at lunchtime.
Pádraig, thank you. Addition year students, that's the ones doing an extra year at secondary school just after their junior cert, will now have the chance to do their work experience at a government department, the Department of Foreign Affairs. Our education correspondent Emma O'Kelly is with us. Emma, tell us more.
Yes, Gavin. Well, the year is a hugely popular one among students. It's a year out, if you like, from the grind of the narrow curricular exam-based approach. And within that, they do 2 weeks or more doing work experience. And now, as you said, for the first time, the Department of Foreign Affairs is inviting inviting students in, 30 students. They expect a lot of competition for those places, so they'll allocate them on the basis of an essay that will be written by students, or a video on the theme of Ireland's values. Now, I met a group of 10 students last Thursday. They were from Ursuline Convent in Thurles and from Portmarnock Community School, and these students had all just completed their transition year. And with this offer from the Department of Foreign Affairs in mind, I asked those students what were the international issues right now that they felt were important for people here in Ireland.
Did you think of anything? The Scottish referendum. We have close ties to the UK and to Scotland and to Wales. So yeah, it's very important to Ireland.
And what about the rest of you? Can you think of anything else? Any other things?
Not really. Like, I think of stuff on, like, if I wanted to move to a different country or abroad, the difficulties of adjusting and, like, the more importance of language, like.
Any other things that are happening abroad that you think Ireland needs to be or should be concerned about? Silence?
No, not really.
You?
I can't think.
What about you?
Nope.
Well, as the whole world, our global population is increasing rapidly, and problems with the amount of food we can supply with ourselves could be an issue.
Emma, almost three out of four Irish students are doing the junior cert now go on to do transition year, but it's quite unique to Ireland.
Yeah, it's believed to be unique. Obviously, it's very hard to ascertain that for certain, but certainly the Department of Education doesn't know of any other programme like it, and it's certainly envied by countries abroad. Now, I spoke to Anna Sullivan of the Department of Education's Curricular Development Unit, and she told me that last year South Korea had sent a delegation to look at our transition year programme and with a view to copying it. Now, this is very interesting because while South Korea has an education system that always tops all of those OECD league tables, etc., it is a very formal, very rote learning and grinds based system, and it's often criticised for that, not great in the whole creativity or initiative front. So on that South Korean issue, here's what Anne O'Sullivan had to say.
They came to the Department of Education, they were just interested in transition year and our experience, because I suppose a feature of the Korean system is they are very, people would say there is perhaps more of an emphasis on rote learning, and the South Koreans are interested perhaps in having a more flexible model of curriculum. Countries envy the opportunity we have in Ireland for students really to have a break from the curriculum and try something different.
So we can pat ourselves on the back?
For once.
That was Anna Sullivan of the Department's Curriculum Development Unit. Thanks very much to our education correspondent, Emma O'Kelly.
Now, a new memorial park in memory of soldiers who died in World War I was officially opened in Wooden Bridge in County Wicklow last week. It has 15 granite headstones showing the names of Wicklow's known war dead, which totaled 1,192 men. The monument is on the banks of the Ochram River, and it's a short distance from where a century ago the leader of the Irish Party, John Redmond, gave a famous speech urging Irish volunteers to join up and fight with the British Army. Angus Cox reports.
In spite of the pleasant happiness and beauty of the scene in which we stand, this country at this moment is at war.
The beauty that John Redmond was referring to in his iconic Wooden Bridge speech of September 1914 is the location for the new war memorial park there. Local Wicklow historian Pat Power is one of those who has been working on the project.
Well, the concept of the memorial is the century has passed and the people who died from County Wicklow in the First World War have never really been remembered, and there was a great danger that they would actually slip out of the heritage consciousness altogether. Well, there are nearly 1,200 names here. It's in the concept of granite pillars taken from the heart of the Wicklow Mountains. There are 15 of them, and they're laid out in a schematic circles which represent the north, the mid portion of County Wicklow and the south part of County Wicklow.
Although the site for the memorial park is picturesque, there is also major historical significance attached to the location, as it was from here that Redmond addressed hundreds of local volunteers.
The volunteers had marched from Rathdrome, Ochram, from Arklow and from various villages around. There were several hundred of them assembled. He had a holiday home up in Ochavanna. The Irish Volunteer Review was going on in Wooden Bridge. He didn't intend to speak at it, but he had to come by Wooden Bridge Hotel on his way to Ochavanna. When the word got out that Redmond was here, he was cajoled to come in and say a few words.
Tom Curran. I'm the chairperson of the Wicklow Development Association. A couple of years ago, we were given a long lease on a plot. The idea came up that this being the 100-year anniversary from Redmond's speech, that the plot that we had was directly across the other side of the river from where he gave his speech. So the idea came up then that we would put in the park a war memorial for the people of Wicklow, the whole of Wicklow, who died in World War One.
It cost a considerable amount of money. Was it difficult to raise?
Well, that was a daunting task. We did apply for grants and we were very successful in getting some grants, but we had to do an awful lot of fundraising ourselves. And that's still an ongoing thing that, while, as you see, looking at it today, it's finished or it's almost finished, there's still maintenance every year.
One of those closely involved in helping to raise the €75,000 required for the project is Sarah Ryan, who is treasurer of the Memorial Park Committee.
We've got a Wicklow Rural Partnership grant. We got a grant from Wicklow County Council, Bray Urban Council, and Arklow Town Council. We ran a race night, a raffle, a barbecue, had a golf classic as well.
How much did you raise yourselves through the race nights, the golf classics?
Approximately €20,000. People were very generous and very kind, and they all turned up on all the nights. You're sort of basically asking the same people all the time for money, but they were all very good to us and very generous. I was actually amazed that we got so many donations, like without even asking. And now that the monuments are up, people have come, they've seen their relatives' names on the monument and they are donating.
And Tom Curran is hopeful that the information gathered to date by members of the community in relation to the Memorial Park will be expanded upon in the future.
One of the problems we had at the time was the amount of information we could put on the stones, and we had to limit it to a person's name. There's close to 1,200 names that we have. Now, we're not claiming that that's definitive. We've made provision for people who will come along and tell us of other names that are there. The plan is to have some sort of access to as much more information that we can get on each individual person that's there, and have that either available on a book form or more likely on a website.
There was great thought given at the end of the Great War in how the dead of the war should be commemorated. The template for nearly all memorials was to try and make some gesture of repentance for the terrible losses. One of the things was, if it could be featured by a river, was to put it by a river. Water was the cleansing agent. Trees regenerated. It was policy from the start to make them as different as they could from what was the horrors of Flanders Fields. The Ockham River, the woodland, is the epitome of what a beautiful memorial park should be.
Account yourselves as men, not only in Ireland itself, but wherever the fighting line extends, in defence of right, of freedom and religion in this war!
And that's an excerpt from that famous speech by John Redmond, delivered at Woodenbridge 100 years ago. And as I say, that monument in Woodenbridge now, as Angus Cox reported, to 1,192 men from Wicklow who died in that war.
€86,732,923 was won in the Euro Millions draw by a ticket holder in Ireland. We don't know who it is yet, but on the phone now to offer them some advice, if they're listening, Mark Westlake, Head of Wealth Management at Goldcorp. And Mark, you used to sit on the advisory board of the National Lottery in the UK. So what sort of advice would you be giving people who won big over there?
That's a very good question. I suppose one of the interesting studies that came out of the States a few years ago was that the more you win, the more likely you are to end up bankrupt. I'm a financial planner, and one of the things that obviously you don't have time to plan for with these eventualities is you know, what you should actually do in these situations. There was another study done in the States looking at the impact of wealthy people passing on money to the next generation. And the things that most families thought would actually bite them turned out not to be true. Most people cited things like the economy and taxes as the biggest problem they faced. And actually, 60% of people said that it was unprepared heirs, people coming down the next generation, that caused the biggest problem for families with this kind of money. So, you know, sitting down and actually thinking about how this is going to change your life is probably the most important thing you could do.
But, I mean, the cautious advice of stick it in the bank or stick it somewhere else and live off the interest, doable?
Well, cautious for that kind of money. I mean, €100,000 is guaranteed if you put it in the bank. So you've got quite a lot of money hanging out there with no guarantee. With this kind of wealth, you really can't just behave in the way that you or I perhaps would think about our own wealth. To put this into some kind of context, the average Premiership footballer in the UK last year earned €2 million. The investment interest on this kind of sum should be in the order of about $4 million a year. So you're earning twice what a Premiership footballer would earn on average. You can't behave or think in the way that a normal, ordinary mortal like you and I would do.
Mark, we could talk about this for an awful lot longer. Just very briefly before I let you go. If the person who's got the money is listening, would you stay quiet?
Crikey. It depends what their views are and what they want to do in terms of with the money. If they want to use it for themselves and their family, I would tend to sort of couch them to think about that with a lot of consideration, because
okay.
You're going to get people coming in and knocking on the door for the rest of your life, I'd imagine.
All right, Mark West, what a hassle. Mark Westlake, thank you very much for speaking to us. If the millionaire is out there, do give us a call.